For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and this week's show is recorded live on location at the Wigtown Book Festival. Welcome to part two of Read On, recorded on location at Scotland's Booktown during the Wigtown Book Festival. Coming up on today's show, Jo Caulfield talks about her memoir, The Funny Thing About Death. Chemist and author Catherine Harcock tells us about the poisons of Agatha Christie, how to build a body, and with James Bond we look at some super spy science. And author Maggie O'Farrell takes us back to the Italian Renaissance in her book, The Marriage Proposal. All that and some brand new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library, one of which is narrated by Meryl Streep, coming up on today's Read On. Jo Caulfield is an award-winning comedian. She's appeared on Have I Got News For You, Mock the Week, Michael McIntyre's Comedy Roadshow, and on Radio 4, The News Quiz, The Now Show, The Unbelievable Truth, and her own comedy stand-up shows. Jo was at the Wigtown Book Festival with her memoir, The Funny Thing About Death. 6 years ago, Jo Caulfield was about to go on stage when she found out that her big sister Annie had cancer. Not the best way to start a nationwide comedy tour, but the tour turns out to be a welcome distraction for both sisters. Jo will join me in a moment to tell me more. But now let's hear from the audiobook, read by Jo herself.
She was 4.5 years older than me, so I have never known a world without Annie. She was already here, ahead of me, being exciting, inventing games and making up stories. One of my earliest memories is of lying in bed and Annie pointing into the sky on Christmas Eve. "There's Santa and his reindeers," she said. I jumped up to see them, and there they were. Santa on a sleigh, soaring through the starry night sky. Who needed hallucinogenic drugs when your older sister could make you see things? The power of a big sister is mighty, but it makes for an unreliable narrator. Purple Smarties were poisonous. The Virgin Mary appeared to her in the bathroom. If I cut my hair, it would grow back blonde. I did, and it didn't. And David Cassidy was her brother. Yes, 70s TV's David Cassidy. He was busy filming The Partridge Family, but visited her whenever he could, she said. It seemed logical. Who wouldn't rather live in California than on an Air Force base in Norfolk? I soon realised that I should believe much of what Annie said in the same way that I believed Shirley Jones was David Cassidy's mother. I knew it wasn't true, but it didn't stop me enjoying the show.
It started as sort of a way of getting things out of my head, basically, when my sister Annie died of cancer. And then I was sort of doing a blog and putting them up on my website. And then it was the comedian Sarah Millican. She was doing a magazine, an online magazine then, and she said, "Oh, Joe, put the pieces in our magazine." And then sort of feedback from people about it, and that they were relating to it. And so then I started writing more stuff. And then it was just memories of my sister Annie, and she was very funny. She was a writer as well. So when I was writing it, I felt very close to her. It was actually, people said, "Oh, is it a hard thing?" And actually, it was like spending time with her. It's like when you lose someone, if you talk to friends and relatives about that person, it's the only way you can have a sort of feeling close to them. So in that way, and then it just sort of spread, and I thought of more stories, and then I realised, oh, I could put in some of her work, particularly shorter pieces, because she had written all sorts, but quite a lot of sort of funny pieces for magazines and stuff. So I put some of those in, which was then a way to talk about her or whatever she was talking about in that piece. And that's a way of keeping her going. So I thought that was a great thing to do as well. And also all of the money for the book is going to Macmillan Cancer Support, because I thought, well, I couldn't profit from it. And also they were so wonderful with Annie that I know she would appreciate that, because she would want to give something back, so she would like that. So the book is like a memoir of sort of two odd girls growing up in the sort of 60s and 70s and coming to London sort of early 80s and trying to get into different things, you know, but sort of unconventional. I was in a band and she was trying to be a writer, and then I did a lot of waitressing and then eventually became a comedian. So it's that, but also then going through the process of grief and that weird way that it hits you when you're not expecting it. And I sort of had friends who would take me out for drinks, and it was almost like they're prodding you, trying to make you cry. And I could see that they're very disappointing with me that I don't seem to be crying. But then it would be odd moments where sometimes it's music, or one time it was I was on tour and I had to change trains. And the train was meant to go to London from Bristol, and then an announcement came up and said, oh, we've got to change at Didcot Parkway, and I just started crying. Like, it was just like, my sister's dead and now I've got to change trains. And the man at the station obviously thought I was crying because I had to change trains. So he was so sweet and really explained in a really slow way how you change trains, and I was just crying then because he was being so nice to me. And then it was weird, then I got out at Didcot Parkway and I was like, well, do you know what? It's not that easy to change there, actually. So it was sort of odd things like that and questions you don't expect. I remember the first time someone asked me, oh, who didn't know me, do you have a brother and a sister? And I had to say, and it took me completely by surprise, because I had said, oh my God, I've got a sister, but she died. And that has never happened again. But when it happens the first time, it was really upsetting. And then I worried that that would keep happening. Mm. And then you realise, oh, you don't have to answer. Depends who it is. And like my little neighbour, who's 9, was like, oh, no, do you have brothers and sisters? So obviously I'm not going to tell a 9-year-old, well, I had a sister and she died. You just gloss over it, you know. But at the time, it's one of those things that sort of sticks. So sort of things about that, about grief. But also, I think in a positive way, how I think my sister left me people. She left me her friends and her partner, and we kind of looked after each other. And I've gained them in my life as sort of gifts from her. And also raising money for Macmillan and being any kind of fundraising, you realise, oh, there's this huge network of people that will help you. And also in the grief club as well. Sometimes it's just knowing that somebody else feels it. And I didn't realise, oh, there's this club, millions of people, and they get it, and they understand what you're going through, and that is a comfort to everybody. So in a way, I hope it's sort of funny and hopeful as well, as obviously being sad.
Oswald Twissel, pronounced Ozzle Twizzle. That's where I was when I found out that Annie was ill. I was in the middle of a stand-up comedy tour. I thought the name sounded like a character from Dickens. Mrs. Ozzle Twizzle, always fussing and will never get her inheritance. But it's actually an old mill town that had been the home of James Hargreaves, the inventor of the spinning jenny. This was a fact that had lain dormant in my brain since O-level history, and it made me strangely excited to be there, like meeting a celebrity, the spinning jenny man. My show at Ozzle Twizzle hadn't sold well, so I'd booked myself into the poshest hotel in the area. I like to double down on financial disaster if ticket sales are slow. The hotel room was one of those ones that looks good but is actually completely impractical and badly designed. Design has nothing to do with price. Cheap chain hotels like Travelodge and Days Inn have very well designed rooms. Ibis have those weird moulded bathrooms that, although perfectly functional, always make me feel that I'm on a cruise ship. A cruise ship that is way off course going through Doncaster.
You were about to kick off a stand-up tour when you got the initial email from your sister saying, okay, this is happening.
Yeah.
Was that in the back of your head when you were on stage? Was it hard trying to be funny when you knew this process had started?
It's funny how your brain just clicks in. I suppose it's like anyone at work. You're going, oh, I'm at work. And I felt, oh, I'm lucky that at least I like my work. So when I was on stage, I had that little kick of adrenaline that helped me through. And then it would be afterwards, the travelling, the being in a hotel on your own, that did become harder to the point where a little while I thought, I'm not going to tour on my own for quite a while because I'm not as resilient as I was before she died. But I'm about actually to just start doing a tour for the first time since she died, because that became harder. But I think I'd be okay with it now. But it is funny how you could still, you know, your brain puts things in little compartments, doesn't it? But at the same time, it's always in the back of your head, yeah.
Storytelling, or lying, is quite a skill. You can't just jump into it. I learned this lesson early in life, a very valuable one, considering that years later I would become a comedian. Conditions need to be right. You need to know your audience. When I was about 6 years old, Annie 10 or 11 and our brother James 8, we were playing on a bit of wasteland on the RAF camp. The ground was muddy and had dried hard into a crazy paving pattern. James and I were following Annie, putting our feet neatly onto each dry slab, trying not to touch the edges. That was the game. This was a familiar order in our childhood, Annie, James, and then me. Annie said, "Don't leave your foot on too long, or the cracked edge will separate and you'll fall all the way down to Africa. You'll land in the Sahara Desert." What an amazing thought. I could completely imagine this piece of dry mud whooshing down cartoon style through the earth and then suddenly popping up with me on it in Africa. In fact, Journey to the Center of the Earth was one of my favourite films at the time. I had loved the scenes of people walking through galleries of molten rock. We all hopped much more quickly from one slab to the next, now with the added danger of being whooshed to Africa. It was that non-threatening danger that made you slightly hysterical with laughter. Laughing would slow you down, which made you laugh even more as you knew you had to keep hopping. But you couldn't keep hopping because you were laughing so much.
You read the audio version of the book. How was that?
Yes. Now, first of all, it was a thing I'd never done. So I was really lucky with the engineer sort of helped me. He said, "Well, let's start and then I'll probably get you to redo the beginning." And that was exactly it, because it takes you a while to work out, well, what's my voice? How do I talk? So he said, "No, now it sounds like you're being yourself. So we'll go back and do the first chapter again." And there was only one moment that I had to stop that was really emotional. Because I'd rewritten the book so much, I was sort of familiar with it, but there was one bit that's just really, really sad and hit me. And so I kind of had to stop. But I was surprised there weren't more moments like that that I did sort of mostly manage. Because again, you're sort of putting your brain into, I'm at work now, so I mustn't be emotional. But there was one bit where I was like, oh, I just can't. And also it was, I know it sounds weird, but I enjoyed it because I enjoyed the book, which I don't know if that's a really arrogant thing to say, but I was like, oh, I'm really enjoying this book that I happen to have written. So that was odd and I saw what was funny. That was good to read it out loud and go, oh, no, that is funny. But I suppose that's the comedian in me was going, oh, where is the joke? Oh, no, there is a joke. That's good. And also you notice it was actually very good that I did the audio before the book had been published, because I noticed a couple of little sentences where I thought, oh, that doesn't sound good when it's read out. So I changed it, corrected things. And two times there was information, and the editor hadn't seen this and nor had I, the information the reader needed. And I thought, oh, they don't know that that happened, so they don't understand that. So I had to go back and put in just that little piece of information. So in that way, I thought, it's a really good check on a book before you publish is to do the audio of it.
A little while later, I was playing in that same area without Annie. I was with Julie and Dawn Troughton, who lived across from us and were a bit younger than me. I told them about the cracked, crazy paving mud and how it would open up and we would end up in Africa. But it didn't work the same way as when Annie said it. They went crazy. Julie became hysterical, but not in the good laughing way. Then, as she stared terrified at the screaming Julie, Dawn started frantically yelling, "Get me off! Get me off!" The grassy area was only about 20 feet away, but Dawn just kept jumping up and down on the spot, which, if the story had been true, was exactly the wrong thing to do. I told them it was made up, that it wasn't true, but they wouldn't believe me. They just kept bawling. So I had to physically pick up Dawn and half drag, half carry her to safety. I lay on the grass waiting for them both to calm down so we could play some more. But they wanted to go home. Next thing I knew, their mother was glaring at me like I was some kind of maniac. "Why would you say such a horrid thing, Joe?" Julie was still crying, rocking back and forth. Jesus, it was just a story. I knew it was a story when Annie said it to me. So how did they not know it was a story? a scary, fun story.
The Funny Thing About Death, written and read by Joe Caulfield, is available commercially. Still to come in part two of my trip to the Wigtown Book Festival, Maggie O'Farrell, and some super spy science with Catherine Harkup. But before that, let's check in with Lynn Livingston to hear some new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library.
We have a terrifically dark crime debut, Death of a Bookseller by Alice Slater. It was donated to RNIB by Hodder.
The Murder Girls drew a different energy to the metal bands I usually went to see at Brixton Academy, where the crowd was rougher, tougher. I felt more at home surrounded by battered biker jackets and combat boots than I did with Zara dresses and publishing tote bags. I joined the back of the queue behind two student types, plain girls with long, limp hair dressed in ironic charity shop chic. One wore an oversized tartan shirt and ugly 80s glasses that reminded me of Jeffrey Dahmer, while the other wore a black T-shirt that said, "I wonder if serial killers think about me as much as I think about them," in a girly pink calligraphy. "If they do Ted Bundy," Dahmer glasses said to the other, "I'll die." "They did Ted Bundy," her friend replied, "like 2 years ago." "Yeah, but so much has happened since then." "So much has happened since when?" I bristled. "Ted Bundy was dead, executed by electric chair by the state of Florida in 1989. These fake fans had no idea what they were talking about. I made a derisive scoffing noise and, startled by the interruption, they turned to look at me. They shared matching looks of distaste as they took in my purple hair, my clothes, my whole dark vibe.
Roach, bookseller, loner and true crime fanatic, is not interested in making friends. She has all the company she needs in her serial killer books, murder podcasts and her pet snail. That is until Laura joins the bookshop. With her cute, literary tote bags and sunny smile, she's everyone's favourite bookseller. But beneath the shiny veneer, Roach senses a darkness within Laura, the same darkness Roach possesses. And as curiosity blooms into morbid obsession, Roach becomes determined to be a part of Laura's story, whether Laura wants her in it or not.
"What?" Dharma glasses snapped. "Ted Bundy died," I explained slowly, like she was very stupid. "Like 30 years ago?" They exchanged uneasy glances, and then Dharma Glasses said, "So?" "So realistically, how much more could have happened to a dead man?" I was being sarcastic, but then something occurred to me. What if there had been a development, a fresh angle or some new information, and I'd missed it? With a flutter of excitement, I took a step towards her. "Wait, has something happened? Have they connected him to a cold case?" "I was talking about the film," she said, taking a step back. Her friend brightened as I deflated. "Ah, Zac Efron." "Exactly." With that established, they turned their backs on me and continued their conversation about extremely wicked, shockingly evil and vile at a much lower volume. I wished I had a friend with me, a partner in crime to make the whole thing more bearable. I'd mutter something like, "Hope they cover Zac Efron," in a silly, girly voice, and we'd stifle our mean laughter. Instead, I plugged in my headphones to listen to yesterday's episode again. I usually listen to every episode twice, because I always miss stuff the first time around. The Murder Girls never scripted their shows, so there was always an edge of spontaneity, and each live show was unique. They only ever posted one live episode per tour, so if you weren't at every show, you'd never know what you'd missed from the others. The only way to catch everything, every joke and every anecdote, every story and every detail of every murder, was to go to as many shows as possible.
Death of a Bookseller by Alice Slater is narrated by Victoria Blunt and Emma Noakes and runs for 11 hours 59 minutes.
HarperCollins has donated the latest book by reader favourite Linwood Barclay. It's called The Lie Maker.
He could have someone out there, the man said, pulling back the front window curtains a tentative inch. Watching the house right now. He was careful not to step directly in front of the glass as he peeked outside. It was raining. Streetlights reflected in the puddles. He ran his fingers nervously through his thick, dark hair. His handsome features were undercut by the fear in his eyes. He wasn't used to being afraid. He was unaccustomed to the role of prey. "He'll have found someone else to do his dirty work," he said. "Jesus, when are they going to get here?" He looked at his watch. "They're 10 minutes late. What the hell's keeping them?" He'd been directing his comments to his wife, a reedy, auburn-haired twig of a woman who looked ready to break into several pieces. She'd made several trips back and forth to the kitchen trying to keep busy. "Do you think they'll want coffee?" she asked. "They're not going to want any goddamn coffee," he snapped. She took a seat on the flowered couch, crossed her right leg over her left, then her left over her right. Some movement on the stairs caught her eye, and she spotted the 9-year-old boy sitting on one of the upper steps watching from between the railings, a tear running down his cheek.
A man desperately tries to track down his father, who was taken into witness protection years ago, before his enemies can get to him. "Your father's not a good person. Your dad killed people, son." These are some of the last words Jack Given's father spoke to him before he was whisked away by witness protection, leaving Jack and his mother to pick up the shattered pieces of their lives. Years later, Jack is a struggling author, recruited by the US Marshals to create false histories for people in witness protection. Jack realizes this may be a chance to find his dad, but then he discovers he's gone missing and he could be in serious danger. Jack knows he has to track him down, but how will he find a man he's never truly known? And how will he evade his father's deadly enemies? Enemies who wouldn't think twice about using his own son against him.
"Go upstairs," she told the boy. "I want to say good..." "Go to your room and close the door," she said, flinging her arm, pointing up. As she brought her arm back, she wiped a tear from her cheek. The boy sniffed and retreated from view, waited until his mother was no longer looking his way, then resumed his position. From where he sat, he could see the front door, the 3 suitcases sitting there, his father still watching the street. His mother was up again, walking around the couch, going into the kitchen. He could hear the rattling of cups, silverware. When she reappeared, her husband was still standing near the window. "Get away from there," she said. He let the curtain fall and stepped away. "It's not too late, Rose," he said. "The two of you can still come. They've prepared the documents in case you change your mind." She stood behind the couch, her hands resting atop the cushions as though using it as a barrier. Her jaw hardened and her eyes moistened. "If you're desperate for company, why don't you take your father?" she said. "Maybe he'd like to start all over again with you. He's all alone."
"I can live without ever seeing him again. It's been years. But the 3 of us, we belong together. Once I walk out that door, once they put me in the car, that's it. It's not safe staying behind. If he can't get to me, he'll come after you."
"And what would be the point of that?" she asked. "To get back at you? You've already washed your hands of us. And we certainly won't be able to tell him anything. You could be in Timbuktu, for all we know. They can pull out all my toenails if they want, but I won't be able to tell them a thing." "We'll take our chances. Your new friends, they'll keep an eye on us."
The Lie Maker by Linwood Barclay is read by Jonathan McLean and Graham Halstead and runs for 10 hours 18 minutes. Dr. Catherine Harkup is a former chemist and author. She completed a doctorate on her favourite chemicals, phosphates, and then went on to further postdoctoral research before realising that talking, writing and demonstrating science appealed a bit more than hours slaving over a hot fume hood. Among her many science books are A is for Arsenic, The Poisons of Agatha Christie, more of which later on. We'll also touch on her book Making the Monster, The Science of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. But Catherine was at the Wigtown Book Festival to talk about super spy science. Science, death and tech in the world of James Bond.
A white dot moves across the screen. A man appears at its centre. The circle follows him as he walks. Suddenly he turns, aims a gun, and shoots. Red washes down the screen, and loud, familiar notes blast out from the speakers. Bright colours, abstract shapes, and silhouettes of writhing women appear. Within seconds, we know exactly where we are and what to expect. More or less.
The audio version of Super Spy Science is read by Nikki Diss.
The James Bond theme, the gun barrel sequence, the highly stylized titles, it was all there from the start. The only things missing from the first Bond film were a pre-title sequence and a title song. The following 24 films would be introduced in almost the same way, rearranged and reinterpreted, but instantly recognisable as part of the same franchise. Each new cinematic edition is simultaneously comfortingly familiar and new and exciting. It is an impressive trick the producers pull off, repeatedly reinventing a highly formulaic series of films that draws audiences of millions back for more, time and time again.
Super Spy Science is a fun look, very tongue-in-cheek at the science of James Bond, all of those big gadgets, the big plans to take over the world, and whether they've been based in a grain of truth or if they're just the figment of some fevered imagination.
And you're more interested in the evil side of James Bond.
Much more fun, in my opinion. James Bond is fantastic, but he's only ever as good as his villains. If he's not up against a credible foe, then why would we be interested in him? And James Bond is remarkable. He has a fantastic set of skills. He has Q Branch behind him, inventing all sorts of things. But the villains, I think, get a bit more creative and they're a bit more... Well, they're quite ambitious in their goals. So that's the side of it that appeals more to me.
The bad guy is living in very comfortable and technologically well-appointed seclusion, a subterranean palace located on Crab Key Island, with a dragon and swamp to deter visitors, but also luxurious guest accommodation and prison cells for those who can't take the hint, along with a nuclear power plant on the side. With elaborate courtesy, the villain explains his plan for world domination, disrupting rocket launches from the USA using some kind of nuclear-powered radio transmitter. And the villain does all this before trying to kill Bond in an extravagant and convoluted way that enables his escape. The film finishes with a spectacular set piece involving lots of explosions and Bond getting the girl.
Now, if you were a villain living in a hollowed-out volcano, wouldn't that smell quite a bit?
Yeah, it would smell an awful lot like rotten eggs. It would be extremely unpleasant. But I imagine that Blofeld is just going for the looks, and it does look incredible. I just wouldn't want to be there. So I'm quite happy that it's just on screen and I don't have to be in the vicinity. But I love all of those big, fantastic sets. Absolute credit to the filmmakers. They're brilliant.
Dame Agatha Mary Clarissa Christie, 1890 to 1976, the Queen of Crime,
holds the Guinness World Record as most successful novelist of all time. She has been outsold only by the Bible and by Shakespeare, and is more widely translated than the Bard. Christie is also the author of the world's longest-running play, The Mousetrap, and created not one but two of the best-known fictional detectives, Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple. Praise, prizes and awards have been heaped on Christie for her work, and her books and plays are still loved by millions.
Now, a lot of our listeners are big fans of the audiobooks of Agatha Christie. Tell us about your book, A is for Arsenic.
A is for Arsenic is a very deep, well, it's a deep dive into the poisons that Agatha Christie used in her murder mystery novels. So Agatha Christie is well known as the Queen of Crime, but she is also the Princess of Poisons. She used more poisons more often to kill more characters more accurately than any other crime writer. And her use of poisons, for me as a chemist, is incredibly creative. And some of those poisons, they're almost like an extra character in the book. They are so evocative of the golden age era of crime. And I was just fascinated about how she used them, what clues she might reveal in their use, and how credible it was.
Christie's detective stories repeatedly demonstrate that she was a master of misdirection. She presented clues fairly and in plain sight, often drawing attention to them, but safe in the knowledge that most readers would form their own wrong conclusions. When the murderer is finally revealed, readers are generally left kicking themselves that they didn't spot the obvious, or they cry foul and go back to the beginning, only to discover the clues were there all along. Christie took advantage of her detailed knowledge of dangerous drugs to help develop her plots. She used poisons in the majority of her books, far more than any of her contemporaries, and with a high degree of accuracy, but she did not expect the reader to have detailed medical expertise. The symptoms and availability of drugs are succinctly described in everyday language, and somebody with a degree in toxicology or medicine has no real advantage over any other reader. Chemists, pharmacists, and similarly qualified people may be able to eliminate certain possibilities early on in the novels, but the revelation of the murderer is just as surprising to them as it is to anyone else. An understanding of the science behind the poisons Christie used only gives a better appreciation of her cleverness and creativity in plotting.
And our use of potassium in Dumb Witness is a particular favourite of yours.
It is a bit of a favourite of mine. Dumb Witness is perhaps not one of her best known novels, but it is a really creative use of a poison I don't think many people have heard of, but it's certainly, it would have been more known at the time she was writing, back in the 1930s, that particular novel was published. And it has just a fascinating history, which I dive into a bit in the book, as well as her particular use of it. So it's part history, it's part sociology, part criminology, real-life crime, as well as murder mystery.
Now, two of your books we have in the RNIB Talking Books Library are Death by Shakespeare and your book about Frankenstein. Tell us how we could build a body.
Oh, it's tricky. I don't know why, but Victor Frankenstein, for some reason, he built his body from bits. He didn't get a complete corpse and try and bring it back, which I think is a mistake. That seems to me an extra lot of work. It's going to be very difficult today. Getting hold of body bits is not easy. It's also illegal, I would like to add. Please don't do it. But back in Mary Shelley's day, it was frighteningly easy because it was the day of grave robbers and body snatchers that were supplying anatomy schools. So she would have heard all of those gruesome stories and gave all of those skills to Victor Frankenstein and then had him stitch them all together and bring them to life with the other fascination of the day scientifically, which was electricity.
Now, I know the James Bond books haven't held up well in today's society, especially in the age of Me Too and the age of trying to live a healthier, cleaner, non-smoking life, but recommend a good James Bond title for us.
I would recommend, so this is complete personal prejudice that I am going to recommend this one. I am going to recommend Moonraker because it is set not in exotic locations or far-flung parts of the world. It's in the bit of the UK that I grew up in, which is Kent. So when he's talking about a lorry chase up a hill, I know that hill extremely well. And it's a very far-fetched novel, but it is also the one novel in the Me Too movement where he does not get the girl. The girl walks straight past him and into the arms of her future husband. So it's got a very nice ending from that point of view.
Catherine Harkup's books Making the Monster, The Science Behind Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and Death by Shakespeare, Snakebites, Stabbings and Broken Hearts are both available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. A is for Arsenic and Super Spy Science are both available in audio commercially, and the RNIB version of Moonraker is read by George Hagen.
The 238s roared simultaneously. The walls of the underground room took the crash of sound and batted it to and fro between them until there was silence. James Bond watched the smoke being sucked from each end of the room towards the central Ventaxia fan. The memory in his right hand of how he had drawn and fired with one sweep from the left made him confident. He broke the chamber sideways out of the Colt Detective Special and waited, his gun pointing at the floor, while the instructor walked the 20 yards towards him through the half-light of the gallery. Bond saw that the instructor was grinning. "I don't believe it," he said. "I got you that time." The instructor came up with him. "I'm in hospital, but you're dead, sir," he said. In one hand, he held the silhouette target of the upper body of a man. In the other, a Polaroid film, postcard size. He handed this to Bond, and they turned to a table behind them, on which there was a green-shaded desk light and a large magnifying glass. Bond picked up the glass and bent over the photograph. It was a flashlight photograph of him. Around his right hand, there was a blurred burst of white flame. He focused the glass carefully on the left side of his dark jacket. In the center of his heart, there was a tiny pinpoint of light.
George Hagen reading from the RNIB version of Moonraker, as recommended by chemist and author Catherine Harkup. Still to come on today's Read On, I'll chat to Maggie O'Farrell about her book The Marriage Proposal. But from that classic recording of James Bond, let's hear two brand new books in the RNIB Talking Books Library. These ones narrated by Meryl Streep and Alfie Bow.
The latest book by the award-winning Anne Patchett is called Tom Lake. It was donated to us by Bloomsbury and is read by the amazing Meryl Streep.
That Veronica and I were given keys and told to come early on a frozen Saturday in April to open the school for the R-Town auditions was proof of our dull reliability. The play's director, Mr. Martin, was my grandmother's friend and State Farm agent. That's how I was wrangled in, through my grandmother. And Veronica was wrangled because we did pretty much everything together. Citizens of New Hampshire could not get enough of our town. We felt about the play the way other Americans felt about the Constitution or the Star-Spangled Banner. It spoke to us, made us feel special and seen. Mr. Martin predicted a large turnout for the auditions, which explained why he needed use of the school gym for the day. The community theater production had nothing to do with our high school. But seeing as how Mr. Martin was also the principal's insurance agent and very likely his friend, the request was granted. Ours was that kind of town.
In the spring of 2020, Lara's three daughters returned to the family's orchard in northern Michigan. While picking cherries, they begged their mother to tell them the story of Peter Duke, a famous actor with whom she shared both a stage and a romance years before, at a theatre company called Tom Lake. As Lara recalls the past, her daughters examine their own lives and relationship with their mother, and are forced to reconsider the world and everything they thought they knew. Tom Lake is a meditation on youthful love, married love, and the lives parents have led before their children were born. It explores what it means to be happy, even when the world is falling apart.
We arrived with our travel mugs of coffee and thick paperback novels, Firestarter for Veronica and Dr. Zhivago for me. I liked school fine, but hated the gym and everything it stood for. Team sports, pep rallies, vicious games of kickball, running in circles when it was too cold to go outside, formal dances, graduations. But on that Saturday morning, the place was empty and strangely beautiful. The sunlight poured in through the narrow windows just below the roof line. I don't think I'd ever realized the gym had windows. The floors and the walls and the bleachers were all made of the same strips of pale wood. The stage was on one end, behind the basketball hoop. Its heavy red curtains pulled back to reveal matte black nothingness. That's where the action was scheduled to take place. We had instructions to set up one banquet table and five folding chairs in front of the stage. Close, but not too close, Mr. Martin had told us. And then, 92 feet away, under the opposing basketball hoop, we were to set up a second banquet table, right in front of the doors to the lobby. That second table was for registration, which was our job. We wrestled the two folding tables from the storage closet. We brought out folding chairs. We were to spend our morning explaining how to fill out the form. Name, stage name, if different, height, hair color, age, in categories of 7 years, please check one, phone number. The hopefuls had been asked to bring a headshot and a resume, listing all the roles they'd played before. We had a cup full of pens. For people who arrived without resumes, there was space to write things in, and Veronica was prepared to take a Polaroid of anyone who didn't have a headshot and then paperclip it to the form. Mr. Martin told us we weren't to make anyone feel embarrassed for having less experience because, and this was what he actually said, sometimes that's where the diamonds are.
Tom Lake by Anne Patchett is read by Meryl Streep and runs for 11 hours and 23 minutes.
We have the new autobiography of Alfie Bull. It's called Face the Music and was donated by Penguin Random House.
I'm at the edge now, waiting. The first one to go. But maybe that's better. Get it over with. Get it done. I mean, it's sub-zero temperatures, and I'm in my shorts. Just my shorts. It's okay, though. I want to do this. I'm ready. High in the Italian Alps, I'm surrounded by snow, the most spectacular mountains, and a camera crew. Goggles on, rubbing my hands together, I'm about to jump into a hole that's been carved out of the ice and swim underneath it. On television. Almost without realising, I'm plunging downwards, breaking the surface. Feet, chest, shoulders, up to my neck in freezing water. The shock of it takes hold fast, but I breathe like I've been shown by the show's expert, Wim Hof, slow and deep, almost like meditating. Eventually, it's bearable. Still biting, but not eating through me. Now it's exhilarating, energising. I'm part of it rather than fighting against it. Push downwards once you're in. That's what I was told. Really push down, just to get underneath the ice, because it's 10 inches thick, he said. Maybe 12. Okay, Alfie, take a breath. A good, deep breath.
The intimate and uplifting memoir from one of Britain's most loved singers, this is Alfie, Offstage. Bringing his characteristic sense of cheeky humour to the page, in this heartfelt book, Alfie describes for the first time the highs and lows of over a decade singing and performing across the world. from personal dinners with Queen Elizabeth II and following in the footsteps of Elvis in Vegas to the mischievous antics with Michael Ball, Alfie's book takes us backstage to witness his brilliant career memories. But this book is also a heartfelt insight to Alfie's unmasked truth for the first time ever. His unflinching honesty reveals not only the success stories, but also the pressures and how, through challenging times, he's learnt more about himself than he ever thought possible. Face the Music demonstrates to us all that it's not our mistakes that define us, but instead how we choose to come back from them.
But this is just the first hole, halfway along. It's an even longer swim to reach the second opening, the final one. This time it's double the length. Down I go again. Further down this time, no more head banging. I'll save that for rock concerts. Find the line, grip the line, pull myself along the line. Nothing but black water, except for a camera light that looks like it could be coming from a mile away. I'm moving faster now, swimming through with ease, but then I feel the urge to slow down, consciously. I want it all to last, to sense my surroundings, and commit it all to memory. The solitude I feel, looking down at the black water below me, makes me realise how alone I am, how alone I've been. While above, there's this crystal-like shimmer, sunlight filtering through the ice like diamonds. Wim was right, it does look like diamonds, it really does. Forward now, faster, because at some point soon, I need to breathe. Then something occurs to me. This isn't just physical endurance. In fact, for me, it's not really about the body at all. Swimming under this ice, pulling myself through this freezing water, I'm in control of my mind, my emotions and my feelings. And it's the first time I've felt that way in, I can't even think how long, too long, without any control. It's a powerful moment, shedding the bad stuff, letting it sink into the blackness. Then looking up at the underside of the ice, seeing how clear and fresh and bright it is above me. That's where I want to go. That's where I need to head. As I finally come out from under, I'm feeling proud, excited even. But more than that, there's a sense of calm, like a weight has been lifted. The realization that I've gone the distance, and at the same time addressed my biggest fear, overwhelms me. Not the fear of diving into freezing cold water and swimming under ice. That wasn't it. What scared me for so long was the idea that I'd been stuck living with my mistakes forever. That I'd never be able to move on. Now, as I pull myself up and out of the water, I realise something in me has shifted and changed. I'd gone under the ice one person and come out another.
Face the Music, My Story by Alfie Ball, is narrated by Alfie Ball and runs for 6 hours and 13 minutes.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
And finally, on today's Read On, recorded at the Wigtown Book Festival. Maggie O'Farrell is the author of Hamnet, winner of the Women's Prize for Fiction 2020, and the memoir I Am, I Am, I Am, both Sunday Times number one bestsellers. Other novels include After You've Gone, My Lover's Lover, The Distance Between Us, The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox, and The Hand That First Held Mine, which won the Costa in 2010. Maggie was at the Wigtown Book Festival to talk about her book The Marriage Portrait, a dazzling evocation of the Italian Renaissance in all its beauty and brutality. It's winter in 1561. Lucrezia, Duchess of Ferrara, is taken on an unexpected visit to a country villa by her husband, Alfonso. As they sit down to dinner, it occurs to her that her husband has a sinister purpose for bringing her here. He intends to kill her. What is Lucrezia to do with this sudden knowledge? What chance does she have against Alfonso, ruler of a province and a trained soldier? The marriage portrait is a reimagining of the life of a young woman whose proximity to power places her in mortal danger. The audio version is read by Genevieve Gaunt.
A foreign dignitary arrived in Florence presenting the Grand Duke with a painting of a tiger. Cosimo was very taken with the gift, and it wasn't long before he expressed a desire to own one of these vicious, singular beasts. He kept a menagerie in the basement of his palazzo for the diversion of visitors, and he felt that a tiger would be an excellent addition to his collection. He gave an order to his consigliere ducale, Vitelli, that a tiger must be found, captured, and brought to Florence. Vitelli, who had foreseen such an outcome ever since the painting arrived at court, heaved a deep and private sigh, duly making a note in his ledger. He hoped that the Grand Duke might be persuaded against the plan, or even forget it, occupied as they were at that time by Republican unrest in Siena. Cosimo, however, refused to comply with Vitelli's secret hope. "What progress on the tiger?" he asked one day, without warning, as he stood on the terrace, readying himself to leave for his daily exercise, removing his lucco and strapping on his weapons. Vitelli, caught off guard, fumbled with the fastening of his ledger, and managed to mumble something about difficulties with certain nautical routes from the east. Cosimo was not fooled. He fixed Vitelli with his left eye, while his errant right eye looked off to the side, at a place just beyond where Vitelli stood.
It's based on the true story of a young Renaissance duchess who realises that her husband is about to kill her.
And what was the inspiration behind it?
Well, two things, actually. It was a poem and a painting. So I always loved Robert Browning's most famous poem, My Last Duchess. And in it, it features a duke who pulls back a curtain, showing a visitor his paintings. And he says, "This is my previous wife, and by the way, I murdered her." So I thought that I really wanted... I've always loved the poem, and I thought I really wanted to write the story that she herself might have told it. I thought she's been behind that curtain for hundreds of years. It's time for her to have her say. So I looked online, and I found a portrait of her. So she was called Lucrezia de' Medici, and she was 16 when she died. And Angelo Bronzino did a very beautiful painting of her when she was 15. And in it, she looks very anxious. She looks very worried. She looks as if she has something she wants to say. So it made me want to write her story.
She is walking in soft shoes and a flowing yellow dress. She has a pale blue cap on her head, on which the sun throws down gentle probing arrows. They land on her crown, her forehead, like the pats of a tame animal. She holds out a hand on either side of her, each palm brushing against the upper leaves of the box hedges that line the path. The sun finds her hands too, such a thorough, tireless sun this, making the skin prickle and seethe. Her footsteps are slow and measured. She can walk with every footstep pressing a print into gravel at her own pace, in any direction she chooses, for as long as she wishes. There is nobody here to bother or pester her or put her in danger. She can go where she pleases, Alfonso told her so, using these exact words, where she pleases. This thought effervesces inside her, bubbling up her throat to exit her mouth as a sound halfway between a laugh and a squeak. Around her, the garden stretches, impassive and incurious. She is alone, apart, that is, from a man with slightly bandy legs and a curved knife in his belt. Alfonso said this man would accompany her on her walks, always at a distance, and that she must not give him a second thought, and that if she wanted for anything, she could summon him and he would be at her side in seconds.
Now, one thing we won't get if we download your book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a small description of the cover?
The cover is an absolute beauty. It's up there with my favourite covers of mine. It is mostly green and it's a kind of jungly, background and it's got a tiger leaping across it. So it's not exactly Renaissance art, but it's certainly very, I think anyway, it's very beautiful and it's very intriguing.
Now, the audio version is read by Genevieve Gaunt. Let me say this first. Given your reading at the start, have you never fancied narrating any of your own audiobooks?
I think I'd be really bad at it. When I was a child and a teenager, I had a really bad stammer. So actually reading aloud and talking aloud is kind of difficult. I mean, I've had a lot of speech therapy for it, so I'm better than I used to be, but it's still problematic for me. So no, I'm more than happy to leave it up to professionals such as Genevieve.
As I say, Genevieve Gaunt narrates this L. Potter narrated Hamlet. Do you have any say in the narrators of your books?
I do, actually. Yes, they're very nice. The people who record them often send sort of 4 or 5 samples of voices. And I thought Genevieve was very good because she's quite young. So she's obviously narrating the story of a 16-year-old. And I think also, I'm right in saying she's half Italian. So she does the Italian pronunciations, particularly with real panache.
Is it important to you that your books are available in accessible formats for people, for whatever reason, can't access print?
Absolutely. I mean, a story is a story. And I think, you know, if we go back to our very human origins, all stories were told orally. So I think it's a very important tradition for us.
He is a good man with a family to provide for. I chose him for the job myself. It would be a pity if he were to be punished for letting you leave alone, would it not? She allows there to be a pause. It grows between them there on the path. A dignified silence, one that tells him that she is a duchess, above behaviour as petty as his, that she is considering his suggestion and will let him know her answer in good time. She will not look at him while she maintains the stillness. She considers the path leading away from her, the way it draws the eye along the valley floor between fields and enclosures, through woodland narrowing and vanishing. She looks back at the villa, its gables glowing red, the windows reflecting repeating squares of clouds. "Very well," she says finally, and she turns back the way she came. Leonello gives the bridle of the horse a sharp tug and walks along beside her. From their saddle gibbet, the hares swing and sway.
The Marriage Portrait by Maggie O'Farrell is available in print, as an e-book, and in audio, as read by Genevieve Gaunt, both commercially and in the RNIB Talking Books Library. Thanks once again to everyone at the Wigtown Book Festival. There's still much more to come with Kate Moss, Nigel Planer, Michael Morpurgo and Rory Ceylon-Jones appearing in future editions of Read On. If you can't wait until next week, there are 341 to be exact, back issues of Read On available on our podcast feed. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app.